people beforehand. It's like, didn't used to bother me, but it bothers me now. Well, some time ago, I didn't look up and see exactly when it was. It's been a while. I gave a sermon here that I titled Waters of Chaos. And in that sermon, excuse me, we discussed the way the Bible uses untamed waters as a symbol for the chaos in the world. Chaos over which God has control, but he hasn't actually taken control and eliminated all that chaos to this point. He hasn't put an end to it. So we looked at it. We looked, and I showed this old map from the 16th century, I think it is, and it shows monsters out there. And we just talked about that. You know, the idea that the oceans are untamed and there are monsters there that are dangerous to people. It was part of the mindset for most of humanity's history. Anybody who lived near the ocean knew about the ocean. And the seas represented things that were unknown. And we didn't really know. We still don't know what's at the bottom of the oceans. I've read before, and I think you've probably read that we know more about the backside of the moon than we know about the bottom of our own oceans. So there's still a lot of unknown there. One of the things that the Bible talks about are the creatures. And here, this is Isaiah 27. In that day, the Lord will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, or Nakash, that term, with his fierce and great mighty sword. Even Leviathan, the twisted serpent, the Nakash, and he will kill the dragon. That's Tanin, another word, who lives in the sea. So there are names in Scripture, like Nakash and Tanin and so forth, that are referring to their names for creatures that live in the ocean, or maybe that don't live in the ocean, you know, that could be mythical in a way, but it's a symbol of things that are not under control and that God will deal with eventually. And not only are these names talk about whether it's a creature or whatever, I'm going to move away a little bit. I think I'm in front of that just a little. It also, the Bible uses these terms to refer to human beings. Like, you got Pharaoh here, and in Ezekiel 29, and also later on, I think it's 39, that didn't write it. It calls him the great monster, the Tanin, and that he has scales. He doesn't. He's a human. But the point is, he is a problem. He's a problem for Israel, for God's people. Also Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar says in Jeremiah 51, it says, he swallowed me like a monster, like a tanin. So even human beings are referred to as these monsters. And we also know, of course, that in Daniel with the four beasts and in Revelation with the one beast, it has all kinds of things going on with it, that these creatures come from where? They come up out of the seas. So that there is something about the seas that the Bible uses over and over again to symbolize certain things that are negative, certain things that have to do with opposition to God or opposition to God's people. And of course, these beasts are seen as opposing God and opposing God's people. So anything that can be perceived or understood as the enemy of God or of the enemy of God's people is portrayed, or at times portrayed in the Bible, as some kind of a monster from the oceans. Okay, but then we also saw that, and here you have the idea, supposed to be Jesus walking on the water, that God is in control. He's in control now, and eventually, during the time of what we call the New Testament, Jesus showed that he had control over this already. He already had control over the waters. And they realize, boy, he's something special. And that he will take control of the waters of chaos. And when it's all said and done, this is my opinion anyway, Revelation 21:1, when it says there's no more sea, it's not talking about the lack of oceans. It's talking about the fact that there's not going to be any more chaos, that God is going to deal with that chaos on the earth once and for all. So that's a very brief summary of that particular sermon. And, you know, in my opinion here, that new heaven and the new earth is not, it doesn't have to do with whether or not we're going to have water like that. It has to do, we're not going to have chaos. Not going to have chaos then. We mentioned that Genesis talks about how God brought order to the world. You know, this is supposed to be a picture of the Garden of Eden. And it's the garden is there to for a lot of reasons, but it shows us that God takes something that's not useful and he makes it useful. So they had a garden there. But there were areas of the earth that were not made useful yet. The Bible uses three major symbols to illustrate places that are not useful, not productive. One of them is the wild oceans that we just talked about. Another one is the wilderness. You know, the wilderness, that's where he sent the Azazel goat, you know, out to the wilderness. These are places that God hasn't taken control of in the sense of making it all useful and productive like the Garden of Eden. And the third one that I mentioned was darkness. Darkness is a symbol that's all throughout the Bible. And today what I'd like to do is focus on darkness. All right, how do you focus on darkness? But the point I want to focus on is how darkness is used in the Bible and how what we can learn from that. So, first of all, how do you take a picture of darkness? I like to have pictures, and you can't take a picture of darkness. You got, and we got stars and light and whatever, so I could just make the whole side black, but give me a break there. I did the best I could, but I tried to get some pictures of darkness that illustrate darkness, just like I did here with the eclipse. But obviously that's not dark, you wouldn't see it. All right. The first thing I wanted to point out, and this is crucial, that no matter what else we notice in the Bible about darkness, it's important to remember from 1 John chapter 1 and verse 5 that it says that this is the message we have heard from him and announced to you, that God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. In him there's no darkness at all. So whatever it is that darkness stands for, it doesn't stand for anything that has to do with God. It's not God. It's not anything God, that it's not a part of his character. It's not a part of what he does. Darkness is something separate, different from God, and in opposition to God. So just keep this in mind. We'll come back to it at the end. Excuse me. A little congestion. So whatever darkness is in the Bible, it's different from God. It doesn't represent God. But darkness is in the Bible quite a bit. And for those who like titles, Brad, the title is "In Him Is No Darkness at All." That's a direct quote from the King James. The New American Standard that I use has an extra word, changes one of the words or something. But today's sermon title, "In Him Is No Darkness at All," and what we'll touch on somewhat is what's so bad about darkness. So first, let's take a look at the Hebrew Scriptures, at what we call the Old Testament. We'll look at a few verses here to get an idea for how it gets set up. Of course, we see, I don't even know that I put it here, but at the very beginning we have it. In the New American Standard that I use most of the time, some word, and it's usually just one word, a form of this one root. It's translated darkness 111 times. So this word appears in what we call the Old Testament quite a few times. And usually it just is a word that means the way we use darkness in English. It just means it's dark as opposed to light. All right, at nighttime it's dark, or it's dark in a room where the light doesn't come on, and it's light when you do have light. So most of the time, more often than not, in what we call the Old Testament, darkness just means darkness. But it's also used symbolically, and it's also used figuratively, and that's what this sermon is going to be about, obviously, not just what's the difference between when it's dark outside and when it's light. In Genesis chapter 1, this is where it all starts. I like to start Genesis 1. "Let there be light." God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw light was good. God separated the light from the darkness. So the first thing that's listed here is what God does. You know, the Spirit's on the face of the waters. The first thing that he does is he separates light from darkness. That's the first organizational thing that he does. Because Genesis 1 is talking about how things are organized, how we're going to start making the earth productive, profitable for humans to use. So he separated the light from the darkness, called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So here we have, you know, something very obvious, a visible contrast, and here it is. You can see there's a line. There's a line. If you could get away somewhere and look, you could see that the light comes around, you know, as the earth spins, that parts go into darkness and parts go into light, and that's just the way it is. And that's the reality. The Bible uses that reality to bring out some other points. Notice in Amos chapter 5, and I love this scripture, and Amos was a shepherd, it says. He was one of the sheep herders. So I assume he was out, I'm reading into the story. I'm assuming he's out there in the pasture, and he's got a pretty good handle on what the stars are, which stars are which. And he writes, "He who made the Pleiades," all right, the seven sisters up there, "and Orion, the hunter," right, "and changes deep darkness into morning," all right, here you have this darkness coming morning as the sun comes up over the, as the earth spins, whatever, you know, it looks like the sun's coming up, changes deep darkness into morning, and who also darkens day and night, so because that, you know, it works the other way as the earth rotates, "who calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the surface of the earth. The Lord is his name. Yahweh is his name." So we have dawn and sunset. We have obvious night and day. We have dark and light. All right. And Amos writes about this. And it's part of what God did as he organized. But how do the Hebrew scriptures use this dark and light to bring out points other than the fact that night is dark and daytime is light? Well, here's one. Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. "Woe to those who call evil good," we understand that, "and good evil, and who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." So here we have a figurative use of light and darkness. And this is nothing new. Isaiah wrote this many, many, many years ago. And we can think, oh, the world's just, you know, getting so horrible, and men are calling good evil and evil good, and light darkness and darkness light. Yeah, but yes, that's true. It is happening, and it's been going on for thousands of years. And so there's nothing new under the sun. But the Hebrew Bible, and especially when we get to the New Testament, often uses darkness and light just to draw a distinction between what's good and what's bad, what's good and what's evil. And it's an obvious use of it. It's an obvious figurative use, and Hebrew does the same thing that we do in English. In Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, and we'll come back to this, "The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them." So here it's talking about Messiah. It's the wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, you know, that thing from Isaiah chapter 9. And later on, it's talking about that people will see a great light from Messiah. All right, then, and it says they walk in darkness. Now, obviously, this is figurative. They're not just walking in the dark where they can't see, but in a way they are. And the Hebrew Bible points that out. Walking in darkness. The light that's going to shine on them is going to come from Messiah. And we'll see that again quoted in the New Testament. Again in Isaiah, and this the word that's translated, I didn't look up how to say it, but the word that, or the root word in Hebrew that's translated darkness and dark, it's used more times in Job and Isaiah and the Psalms than all the rest of the Old Testament put together. So it's 111 times, but the majority of those times, 60 couple times or whatever, it's just in these three books. So here we are in Isaiah 42. "I will lead the blind by a way they don't know, in paths they don't know. I will guide them. I will make darkness into light before them and rugged places into plains." So again, Messiah is going to change the way things are on the earth. And, and it's going to be the same as making, in effect, making a blind man be able to see, or a blind woman be able to see. Because dark, you know, obviously a blind person, they're in the dark, right? That's uses that, it's obvious. But God's going to change that. He's going to change that. And the world won't be walking in darkness. Job, by the way, if you look through Job, and I did this, Job brings up darkness a lot in his self-defense and so forth as he's talking to his friends and talking, you know, by way of his friends, talking to God. And he mentions darkness a lot. Now, why? I think it's because, you know, he's in a dark place. And he's almost like he's in the grave at times, the way he feels. And so he talks like that. And what's interesting to me, and I brought this out on another sermon, but Job has used this word a lot of times. And what's the first thing God says? Job 38, verse 2. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? God throws that word right back at him. Yeah, you've been talking about how dark things are. You're the one that's dark. You're in the dark, actually. You don't know what you're talking about. He says, maybe in a nice way, but you know, he's telling Job, you know, you are the one that's in the dark here. And that's just really interesting. And Job is, the more I read Job, the more interesting it is to me. It's formulaic in a lot of ways, and the different characters say certain things that make certain points and repetitively do that. And here's God responding to Job with his own words. With his own words. You know, you're darkening. So I thought that was interesting. Another way that darkness is used, and this is Isaiah again, and it's talking about Israel being punished, all right? It says, they will look to the earth and behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be driven away into darkness. So what's that mean? You can't take that literally. It's not that we're going to drive them into the night. Even if you do, it's going to be day in a few hours, so that's not what the point is. The point is, like these refugees that you see here, they're getting driven out of their land into a place that's worse off. You know, it's not a good thing. They'll look to the earth and behold distress and darkness. So darkness is a symbol also in the Bible for punishment or for destruction, you know, for bad things, bad ends, bad times. And it's that chaos from the very beginning. So the first thing God does is he separates the night from the night from day, dark from light, right? That's what he does. So it's God taking control of a bit of chaos on the earth, the tohu and bohu. And what the scriptures are doing with light and dark is they're using this to say, all right, destruction is a bad thing. It's a way of getting a taste of the way it was before God separated dark from light. That's why it uses these terms like darkness. It's the same way when we did the waters of chaos that when the Bible sometimes uses flood, talks about a flood, the waters being out of control. It's symbolic. It's not just, yeah, we can understand a flood is water out of control, but it means more than that in the Bible. It means it's a return to before God put boundaries on the oceans and made the dry land and all that. It's a return to the tohu and bohu of the original earth. And so the Bible did that with the oceans and with the waters. Now it also does it, not later, it does it at the same time. It's doing the same thing with darkness. So darkness is a symbol of what's not good with the earth. It's not productive. It's not helpful. It's not good for humans. So God at creation separates light from darkness. And this Bible uses a symbol of this darkness coming back now and again in different ways as a very negative thing, because it's kind of return to the disorganization, the tohu and bohu from the original earth. Finally, in the Hebrew scriptures, and this is an example, Job, right? My days are past, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. They make night into day, saying the light is near in the presence of darkness. If I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. Job's just saying, you know, I might as well be dead. I might as well be in the dark, because in the grave it's pretty dark. Right? That's his point. I'm dark anyway. I might as well just be in the grave. And the Bible uses that terminology again, the dark. This isn't the only place. That darkness as a symbol for death. Actually, it's a darkness that in the Old Testament is not expected to be recovered from. That's where you go. That's where you go. It's dark and it stays dark. Now, in the New Testament, we learn about resurrection more. But it was seen as this place where you just go, it's dark, it stays there. And if we want to summarize here from the Hebrew scriptures, You have dark, light, contrast on Earth. That's the way it's used. It's obvious. We have dark and light. It's a contrast between good and evil. That's dark and light as well. And all this sets up the way it's used in what we call the New Testament, in the apostolic writings. It's a life, darkness is, it's a way of life that's unenlightened by God. You know, some walk in darkness, all right? They're walking in a way that's not godly. It could also mean, in the book of Job, you don't know what you're talking about. You're dark. You're in the dark, all right? Sometimes we're in the dark about something, and we don't know what we're talking about. We think we do, and that's sometimes it's totally innocent. We think we know what we're talking about, and then it's like, oh, no, that's all changed. Too bad. So we didn't know what we were talking about. And it also can refer to destruction and punishment, as we said. You know, bad times coming. And finally, and ultimately, it can refer to death, the darkness of the grave, or Sheol, is the way it's the term in the Old Testament, the Hebrew term Sheol, which is a place where the dead go. And it's dark. And it's just like an end. It's just like a not a good end. It's just where you go. Wait for whatever's next. So now, let's take a look at the Greek. Let's take a look at the Greek scriptures that the apostles wrote and see what it has to tell us about dark and light and how darkness is used. And you're going to get a benefit here. It's a money-back guarantee. You're going to learn something you're not going to hear in any other sermon anywhere, probably, unless the Truman Carpenter gives you that sermon. We're going to talk about darkness, and I got a picture of stairs here. Anybody, maybe you already know, anybody know why I would have a picture of stairs when I'm talking about darkness? No. All right, good. The word, the Greek word that's used for darkness is skotia. All right? There you see it in Greek, and you see how you would say it. Skotia. And that's one of the forms. It's a word that obviously you can use, verb, noun, different forms. This right here, I have an arrow. Guess what that molding's called? Skotia molding. No, we call it Scotia, because we put the T and the I together and say sh. All right, Scotia molding, and we put that underneath of things. Why? Because it's hidden. If you're walking up the step, you look up. If you're looking down, you don't see it. It's underneath the tread. It's Scotia. And so here you go. You learned something. Scotia molding. Maybe you knew what Scotia molding was, but it's because the Greek word means hidden. We'll get to that in a minute. Also, skotos, that's another way that a form of the word. And in classical Greek, this refers, it's figurative as well as literal, but more often in the New Testament, it's figurative. It refers to obscurity. You know, it's obscure. You can't see it. It's under the tread. Or darkness. It can be translated darkness, and it is in the Bible. So this is a normal word. It's not strictly a Bible word. It's just a word that means hidden or obscure in the Greek. And in Greek, it's more concerned with the figurative use. It's not used, I'm not going to say it's not used at all, but more often and most often it's used in a figurative way. It's talking about something that darkness symbolizes or stands for. It's not talking about dark and light. Usually. It can be used literally, but it's not often. Here you go. Here's an example of literal. Matthew 27, it's also in Mark and Luke, but not in John. Now from the sixth hour, or this is the Jesus crucifixion, darkness fell upon the land until the ninth hour. That's not figurative, that's literal. That's a literal use. But how else does it use this word? How else do the Greek scriptures? It's rare to use it in its literal sense. This is, remember Zacharias, and he was struck dumb. He's the father of John the Baptist, the guy we call John the Baptist. And it wasn't until he wrote down that the kid's name should be John, because there were no Johns in the family. He said, what do you want to call him? And he wrote down the kid's name is John, and then he could talk. And once he started to talk, he there's this long, I don't know, there's probably a name for it. I didn't look up to see what the name is. But it's a long prophecy of John's ministry and Jesus' ministry. And just breaking into this here, it's the 78th and 79th verses, so it was a long chapter. because of the tender mercy of our God, with which the sunrise from on high will visit us, to shine upon those who sit in darkness and the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. So this is Zacharias, once he gets to talk again after months of not being able to talk verbally. He says there's going to be this sun, you know, that Jesus is going to come and things are going to change. And John was going to come and prepare the way for him. Who are they shining on? They're shining on those who sit in darkness. And where does that come from? It's back in Isaiah chapter 9, and verse 2. That the Messiah is going to shine on those that are in darkness. And not only that, but here it combines the thought of the shadow or darkness of death. All right, so they're all here, they're here in the same verse or two. So here, the Greek, just like the Hebrew did, is talking about a condition of being not enlightened, of being separate from God, not having the light that comes from God. And Jesus' mission and John's mission was to be a light to those that were in darkness. All right, it's like those who are sick are the ones that need a doctor. Those that are dark need light. So that's the whole point of John's ministry and Jesus' ministry. Here's another verse. This one's from Luke, talking about darkness. It says, the eye is the lamp of your body. When your eye is clear, your whole body is full of light. But when it's bad, your body is full of darkness. Then watch out that the light in you is not darkness. So there's a warning, but it's also saying, you know, the New Testament is more concerned with what's going on inside of us. Are we light inside or are we dark inside? Well, you know, literally we're dark inside. There's not a whole lot of light that makes it through. But, you know, using the eyes, interestingly enough, because the eyes are the one place that light does get through. But the point is, of course, that we are to be different inside and we are to be light inside. And that's not the natural state. So the New Testament, again, the Greek scriptures are concerned with what's going on inside of us, what's going on in our minds, our hearts, and is that darkness or is that light? Paul, as is his, what he's used to doing, he can throw a lot of concepts into the same sentence sometimes, or definitely into the same paragraph or chapter. And notice what he does here in Romans 13, verses 11 and 12. He says, do this, knowing the time, that it's already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. So he's making a point here about night and day or, you know, sleep time and daytime. For now salvation is nearer to us than when we believe. The night is almost gone. Now, he doesn't use the word dark there, but he's talking about night and day. And the day is near. Therefore, let us lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. So here he throws all this together. He's a master at that. He does it a lot. And not only are we to stop our deeds of darkness, but the time is right for that because it's time to get up. It's time for light. It's time to leave the darkness behind. And that's his point. He's telling those of the church there in Rome, you know, that's we need to be moving on here. We need to be laying aside the deeds of darkness. So here, Paul uses this darkness in a way having to do with actions. Not just what we think or not just how we feel, but what are we doing? We can have dark actions. All right? You know, we call them sins. But darkness, you know, Paul uses the day and night idea of darkness to make the point about our deeds. And of course, it works. And so darkness in the Greek scriptures is used to describe works that are not good, that are not godly. All right, so there's another use of the same word. In 1 John, and there are many, many uses of this word figuratively in the writings of John, whether it's 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, or the Gospel of John. In 1 John chapter 1 and verse 6, if we say we have fellowship with him and yet walk in the darkness, we lie and don't practice the truth. So this has to do with actions, but it also has to do with a way of life, walking in darkness. Obviously, we don't want to walk in the dark all the time. But figuratively, that's something that we can do. And we ought not to do that. Darkness is a way of life in the New Testament. It's a way of life. And Jesus came to witness to those that are walking in darkness. But it's still a danger that we have to face. In chapter 2 and verse 9, the one who says he's in the light and hates his brother, he's in darkness. So there's a possibility of deception here. That we don't always know whether we're in the dark or the light. Now, physically we do. If we're not blind, we know when it's light outside and when it's dark. But Paul writes, John writes, and others write, that when it comes to walking in darkness or walking in light, it's easy to be deceived. It's easy to be deceived. So we have to be aware of that. Now, here's Ephesians. I got a long quote here, but I'll just read verses 6 through 14. Let no one deceive you with empty words. All right, so he's talking about deceiving. For because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, don't be partakers with them, for you were formerly darkness. All right, so that's where we came from, darkness. But now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. So the point being made is pretty, I think it's something we know, is that just because we are children of light doesn't mean that that's all we need. All right, I'm good. I know which side I'm on. But it says walk. We have to action. The actions have to match what we say. Yeah, we're children of the light. Do our actions match what we say there? Trying to learn what's pleasing to the Lord. Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness. All right, so we have the works of darkness, the works of light. But instead, even expose them, for it's disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret. But all things become visible when they are exposed by the light. So again, Paul is using darkness and light in several different ways at the same time. And sometimes even hard to follow, but that's, you know, he's making use of these words and, making his points maybe more memorable to those that are hearing this being read in their congregations. All things become visible when they're exposed by the light, for everything that becomes visible is light. For this reason, it says, awake, sleepers, going back to waking up, awake, sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. So he's throwing that in there too, because from his Bible, which is our Old Testament, he knew that light and dark also has to do with death, and that Sheol was a place that was dark. And he's telling the people there in Ephesus, wake up, wake up. It's like arising from the dead. All right. So he's throwing all these ideas in at the same time. So light and dark, you know, sin is the deeds of darkness, and darkness can be compared to death as well. Now, I'm saying chaos is alive and well. Why do I say that? Because in the Greek, again, and it's not so obvious in any of the Hebrew scriptures that I had there, darkness is not just our actions. It's not just what we think. It's not just what we feel. It's not just even a way of life. But it's a system. It's a system that's not of God. That's why I put the beast from Revelation up here. It's a system. And in Colossians, you're in Colossians. I guess you read this last time. For he rescued us. And I love the scripture. Because but I never paid attention to the beginning as much. For he rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son. Now, I've talked about that before, that we are in the kingdom now. And sometimes we don't think that way, but we are. We're in the kingdom now. That's what it says here. We've been transferred. But where have we been transferred from? That's what I didn't pay attention before. We've been rescued from the domain of darkness. What's the domain? Well, it's whatever's controlled by this beast. You know, it's the world system, Babylon, whatever you want to call it, that, you know, is symbolized back in Genesis by the Tower of Babel. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 5 says, for you are all sons of light and sons of day. We are not of night nor of darkness. So there's a system there that is in control. God hasn't taken control of that yet. And it controls the world. And it's not consistent with God's laws. It's not consistent with God's way of doing things. It's not consistent with the kind of life that we should live. And the system is very powerful. Notice 1 John chapter 2 and verse 11. But the one who hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness. Okay. But then it says, and doesn't know where he's going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. This is a different kind of darkness. You know, I've got a friend who was born blind. He didn't walk out in the dark and then get blind. But what John's writing here is that this darkness is a kind of darkness that can blind you. Now, that's something worth thinking about. I mean, you could probably do a whole sermon on it. But, you know, when you wake up like I do in the middle of the night, can't get back to sleep, think about it. We can be blinded by darkness. There's a system that's out there, and it's very powerful. It's very powerful. And it can influence the way we think, the way we feel, in a way that we don't realize that we're being affected by it. And different writers in the New Testament warn us about that. The darkness is not passive. Real darkness is passive, right? It's dark because the sun is on the other side of the earth. That's passive. It's not doing anything to you. But the darkness that the apostles are writing about in the New Testament is a darkness that's actually aggressive. It actually is not passive. It can blind us. It can cause blindness in us. And I just speak for myself. I don't think about that all the time. Sometimes I think I'm smarter than that. Well, you know, it's by God's grace if we're smarter than that. He's like, because he's warning us. You know, we need to stay close to him, or this system will blind our own minds so that we will be a part of the system and not realize it. In the Gospel of John, we've already talked about John, but John 1 verse 5, this is right at the beginning of the Gospel. And of course, John wrote his Gospel, from what we can gather, quite a bit later than the other Gospels. He had more time to think about it, not just him, but the whole church had more time to think about what Jesus' birth, life, and death had really meant. And he adds a lot. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness didn't comprehend it. Okay, that makes sense. You know, it's only by God's grace that we can receive the light. Right? We can't decide that, you know, we're gonna call ourselves. You know, we're gonna give ourselves a faith in Christ. God does that. He draws people to His Son. But it's interesting that it says here, right here at the very beginning of the book, that the light is there, but those that are in darkness don't get it. They don't see it. The light is not visible to those in darkness. All right, so we're getting away from like light and dark outside. There's a darkness that blinds us. And it's only through God's grace, and it makes it possible that we can see and not be blinded. In chapter 3, verse 19, this is the judgment, that light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than the light, for their deeds are evil. And we understand that as human beings. it's the human condition. Chapter 8, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I'm the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Excuse me. So darkness, again, has great power. It's not a passive, like the sun went down, it's dark. It's a power. It's a force, in a way. And it seeks to take control of you and me. And it has control of the whole world. And that's just something we need to keep in mind, because it also says that it can blind us. In chapter 12, Jesus said to them, for a little while longer, the light is among you. Walk while you have the light, so that darkness will not overtake you. He who walks in the darkness doesn't know where he goes. All right, he's just making an obvious analogy here. You know, you can't see where you're going. This morning, early, I had a take a flashlight through the rec room and put it over next to the electrical box where we keep it. And I could see what I was, where I was going when I walked there. And you think, well, can't I walk through my own rec room? Well, if you see our rec room, there were Legos here and other toys. You know, there's stuff all over the place. And so I walked back. I didn't pay attention to how I got in there. And on my way back out, I'm like kicking this and I'm kicking. I was like, oh, I, you know, where am I going to walk here where I'm not going to crush something that they spent hours putting together? And because I can't see. Can't see because it was dark. But here, Jesus is saying that darkness can overtake you. Kind of like when the sun goes down, to use the analogy. But it can overtake us. What's that mean? I mean, that means as human beings, we are susceptible to being blinded by this darkness. And it's not enough that we just claim to be with God, or we're God's people, or we're, you know, we're Christians, or whatever we want to say. That's great. But we need to be vigilant, because the darkness can blind us too. Jesus said in the same chapter today, I have come as a light, or as light into the world, so that everyone who believes me will not remain in darkness. So we have to stay, close, stay connected. In Matthew, now, all right, that's all for that right now. When you're talking about darkness, you look at Matthew in three verses, I'm going to read them. He talks about outer darkness. And I can just give you my opinion here. Okay, this is opinion. But after Jesus was talking to the centurion, remember he was going to heal the centurion's servant or whatever, and the centurion says, hey, you don't have to come to my house. I'm used to giving commands and people do what I say. So just say the word, it'll happen. And Jesus goes, whoa, you know, I don't hear this in Israel. And then he starts talking. Jesus says, when he heard this, he marveled and said to those who were following, truly I say unto you, I haven't found such great faith with anyone in Israel. I say to you that many will come from the east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. In that place there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So the typical Jew of Jesus' time thought to themselves, we're the people of God, we're going to be there at the, you know, the banquet, if you want to call it that, with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, no big deal, because it's our birthright. Who's who we are. And Jesus says, guess what? This centurion might be there, but you won't be. That's a big deal. But then Matthew says, in addition, he writes that they'll be cast into outer darkness. So what's that mean? Let's read a couple more, and then you'll get my opinion. Excuse me. In the parable of the wedding guests, all right, where they had to bring, you know, they couldn't get people to come, and they invited anybody, and then one guy shows up. I think he says it's a man. He showed up, and he didn't have the right garments on. And the king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot and throw him into outer darkness. In that place there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So here we got another one. He goes, get rid of him. Send him out to wherever this outer darkness is. And in the parable of the talents, you had the one who hid the talent, right? He hid one. And gave it back to the master. And the master says, throw out this worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place, there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So I read these things, I go, what's outer darkness? One thing that's obvious is that all of these things talk about being in good relationship with somebody, whether it's your master, whether it's the king, or whatever, with Jesus. And the point's being made that you're not in a good relationship, you're going to be far away. You're not going to be at the wedding supper. You're going to be, you know, wherever outer darkness is. So that's an obvious thing. That Matthew's using that term in a way to say, you're not going to be here where you think you're going to be. You're going to be so far away, we're going to call it outer darkness. And you're not going to want to be there, and it's going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I mean, it's a place you don't want to be. But why is it outer darkness? Here's my take on it. You can take it or leave it. This is a picture. I don't know who made the picture. I've seen it before. It's kind of like the ancient worldview. If you read ancient documents, even the Bible, because the Bible reflects this. It talks, like in the commandment, it says, don't make idols of anything in the heavens above, the earth beneath, or the waters under the earth. Well, they had this idea that You had the heavens above, obviously. You had the earth, and you also had things underneath the earth. All right? Underneath the, you know, right here. And if you can look at some of the Egyptian I don't know what their paintings or artwork in the temples or whatever. They had I forget her name. I didn't look it up, but they had a goddess who, her like tail was supposed to be this arch going here. And the stars and the planets and all were in this arc. All right? And that's what they thought. The idea that the universe went on forever, I don't think anybody was thinking about that at the time. You looked up and you could see these stars. And all we see are stars that are actually fairly close to us. We're not looking at stars in other galaxies. But we can see the stars that are close. And we can see the planets that are in our solar system. And they all appear to be in this, what do you want to call it, dome over our heads. And they realized that something's spinning because that dome moved around and you could see the same thing again and again. And they knew it was a zodiac because it changed a little bit with the seasons. They understood all that. But they don't. I don't think that they had any clue that you go beyond this, and there's anything out there. These stars, they're all here where we see them, and the whole dome looks like it's got stars. You ever been to a planetarium? Yeah, you know, and you look up and they got the dome, and there's all these stars. So, for me, this is me, and I like astronomy and I like science and all this. So. When they talk about outer darkness, you're going beyond this arc. You're going out to where we don't know what's out there. This is some darkness, that, you know, beyond the things that are light that we can see. Way out there. And they believed, I'm not saying that the Israel believed it, but they believed a lot of things that everybody else around them believed, that the stars were gods. You know, the Pharaoh, when he goes into the afterlife, he becomes one of those stars somewhere. And the Bible actually reflects that, because it refers to what as being stars? Angels, right? Angels is like stars. So it's part of the culture. And I don't take it literally. I don't think angels are stars, but it's part of the culture because that's the way they saw the world. That's the way they saw their little section of the universe. And now we have a lot more knowledge than what they had. So I'm not blaming them for anything. So when I think about outer darkness, I'm thinking they're talking about beyond everything we can see. And as far as they knew, it's just dark out there. It's just, it's the chaos, the original chaos that was there before God divided light from darkness. We have light here because we're inside that thing. You get out there, it's dark. You get outside of that, it's dark. So there you go. You got 5 minutes of my opinion for what it's worth. And I think, too, now you're going to get 6 minutes, in my opinion. I think that the way I read the Bible, it's obvious to me that they understood, the people who wrote the Bible, understood that God was going to deal with the chaos on the earth. He's going to make the wilderness, that's the third thing we haven't talked about, right? Going to make the wilderness as the desert wilderness as a garden, right? I think it's in Isaiah. You have all these wonderful things that are going to happen. And the chaos of the waters of chaos, God's going to control them. But I don't see anything in the Bible, maybe I missed it, that says that God's going to do that for the whole universe. And I'm not saying he's not or he is. That's not my point. But my point is they weren't writing about that. They were writing about what's going to happen on earth. Because that's where God was working with, you know, that's where his plan is. That's what he's doing, working with humans. So to me, this outer darkness, it's a place where God isn't, he's not envisioned as dealing with that. And if you got some bad apples, and they talk about it in 2 Peter, in fact, I'll get there here. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. For if God didn't spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell, which is Tartaru, means a place of restraint, and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment. So God's kind of, in a sense, locked up disobedient angels in Tartaru, this place where they're restrained. And it doesn't say It just says they're there for judgment. I don't think the scriptures tell us in any way that God's, you know, got a plan for the entire universe to deal with all the chaos that's out there. That's just me, okay? So, he is going to deal with the chaos on the earth. So I think when Matthew writes, you know, he's quoting Jesus, but I don't know if Jesus used that term or whatever, you know, how it gets translated. But the point is that there's places out there that God's not working with right now. It's darkness. It's going to stay that way for a while. And these people can go there. All right? That's the way I look at it. So since I was covering darkness, I figured I needed to cover outer darkness. And inner. This would be inner darkness, you know, like a Sheol. This, you know, this area, the underworld where the dead go and they just wait, you know, for their judgment. And the ancients didn't believe they're down there being alive. It's just like they're dead. But they're awaiting whatever happens next. So what's so bad about darkness? Where does that leave us? Where does that leave us? Well, let's get a couple take-homes, and we'll wrap up. Darkness is used throughout the Bible to symbolize evil. All right, you saw that both Old and New Testament, as opposed to light, which symbolizes the good that comes from God. Darkness is also used, both Old Testament and New Testament, as a symbol of punishment or destruction. You know, bad times. Darkness has to do with bad times. But in the New Testament, we see some other things. Specifically, an ungodly way of life, a life apart from God. We do see that in Isaiah as well, a little. They also write about sinful deeds and a world system that blinds those who are part of it and has the capability, well, that's the next thing to say, the reality that even a Christian, even you, even me, who have had God's light shine on us, are susceptible to the deception of this darkness. It's something we have to be on guard against and pray that God keeps our minds in line and that we don't get thinking like the beast from the sea that controls a world and the way things are. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against powers, against the world forces of this darkness. All right, there's rulers, there's powers. I think he's talking about demonic things, but it's also, we got our human powers, same thing. It's all part of the same system. Against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. So that's who our struggle's against. All Christians. And then 2 Peter, or 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. We are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, just like Israel was, only now in a spiritual sense. A people of God, for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. We've been called out of that. Let's keep that in mind and stay away from it. We don't want to be blinded by it. It's all around us. It's all around us. We need to stay clear of it. John chapter 1, verse 5. That's the title, right? This is the message we've heard from him and announced to you. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. In him there's no darkness at all. We're children of the light. Let's stay there.